This gig economy is creating exciting opportunities, but it's also raising hard questions about workplace protections and what a good job will look like in the future.
It's a coastal thing, it's a millennial thing, but it's fast growing.
In this gig economy, someone was ready to take the job after the other guy couldn't.
A recent study by Intuit predicted that by the year 2020, 40% of America's workforce will be contract workers.
Human civilization is based on solving collective action problems, and nowhere is that more obvious than in economics.
From the offices of Civic Ventures in downtown Seattle, this is The Other Washington, a podcast on policy and politics from outside the Beltway.
Way outside the Beltway.
Far from the pundits and politicos who dominate the national debate, I'm David Goldstein.
And I'm Paul Constant.
And each week we take you on a deep dive into a single policy issue, explaining how it works,
how it doesn't,
and how conventional politics often gets in the way of effective policy. Welcome to episode 4, the gig economy.
The sharing economy.
The Uber economy. The 1099 economy.
Oh, good one.
Yeah, they all kind of describe the same thing, so why don't you kind of sum it all up for us, Paul? What's the problem here?
Well, in episode 3, we talked about robots and automation, and the sharing economy, or the gig economy, sort of taps into the same sorts of fears. The gig economy is a hybrid market model that refers to peer-to-peer-based sharing of access to goods and services.
Oh, quit the bull. It's about dialing up a car on your phone or going to Airbnb and renting a room in somebody's house instead of a hotel. Something like that.
Well, yeah, except for, you know, there's a person who has to drive the car and or, you know, clean the house that you live in, you know.
So that really gets to the heart of what we're talking about on this show. It's not as much the gig economy or the sharing economy from the consumer perspective, but what it means for American workers and how we sustain a middle class in an economy where more and more people are moving from jobs to this form of 1099 work.
So, Goldie, when you talk about the middle class, exactly what sort of income brackets are you talking about here?
We're not necessarily talking about a specific income level at all. You have to understand here at Civic Skunk Works, a lot of our work is informed by this theory of middle-out economics, which recognizes that the economy grows not from the top down, but from the middle class, and that growth and prosperity in a modern technological economy is really a consequence of the middle class, a thriving middle class, not the other way around. And so when we think of the middle class, we don't think of it as earning above or below a certain income level. For us, it's more a state of mind, a sense of security. Do you feel that you're middle class? And when you do feel middle class, then you feel like you have the security to invest in yourself and in your children, to purchase a home, pay for a college education, save for retirement, maybe even splurge on a vacation or some special gift for your loved ones. This set of benefits and guarantees that we all kind of take for granted, things like healthcare,
401ks,
vacation,
mm-hmm. sick days,
paid sick leave, right? And so, as we move from this old economy where most people worked in for a single company, often at a centralized factory or in an office where you might work there for several decades and have all of these benefits provided for by your employer, into this new, less secure gig economy where you're working for multiple employers, having multiple jobs, sometimes in the same day, let alone in the same year, the question is, where are these benefits going to come from?
Well, see, the problem here is that it sounds like you're trying to turn back the clock and drop us in the middle of a sort of glossy 50s sort of America where everybody is part of a union that just doesn't exist anymore.
even if I wanted to turn back the clock, of course, I couldn't. This is, you know, technology is changing, the economy is changing, and this is where we're heading. In the mid-1950s, only about 12% of the workforce was working part-time. Today, it's closer to around 19%. In the 1950s, there was no smartphone where you could work part-time driving a car for Uber or Lyft or whatever. Today, of course, everybody lives on their smartphone. So that's the world we're living in today. Instead, what we're talking about is not turning back the clock, but finding a way to adapt our policies and our social safety net to acknowledge the new economy in which people are living and in which we are moving at an ever faster pace. As our plutocratic overlord Nick Hanauer likes to say, we need to close that gap between technological innovation and civic innovation.
Hi, I'm Nick Hanauer, and I'm founder of Civic Ventures.
Are we right to be afraid of the gig economy?
What technological innovation has brought over the last number of years is the ability to share resources in ways that we couldn't before. And, you know, Uber and Lyft are great examples of technological innovations that have created a lot of benefit in a lot of people's lives, obviously. I mean, if you live in a big city, there is simply no doubt that getting around via Uber is a big benefit and a marvelous thing. At the same time, we have labor constructs and labor standards that are almost 100 years old now, and we're very, very much built and originated in an industrial economy that didn't anticipate these new dynamics. And the fundamental truth is that, you know, a thriving and dynamic middle class is the source of all prosperity and growth in a technological capitalist economy. And so if you don't build policies to both reinforce and support that dynamism and growth, then ultimately you're going to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. And so it's very important to adjust, again, coming back to civic innovation, very, very important to adjust our labor and work standards to accommodate these fantastic new business models. You know, in the industrial economy, where everything that went into what made up a decent and dignified middle class life from your lifetime employer, you know, the old arrangements made perfect sense. But in a world, in an economic system where somebody may have as many jobs in a year as their parents had in a lifetime, or where someone may actually hold down five separate jobs simultaneously, those old constructs make no sense.
My name is Hannah Brooks Olson, and I am 28 years old. I wish people knew how emergent it feels all of the time. I wish people knew how little sort of respite there is. Like, there just was not, I could not catch a break. I couldn't have a bad day. Like, there, it was not possible. And I wish that people knew that when you not only live paycheck to paycheck, as obviously people have been doing for generations, that's not new, but when you live half a paycheck and half a paycheck and a third of a paycheck and then six paychecks to paycheck, like, you are constantly scrambling, and there's nobody that has your back. And, you know, I loved being self-employed when I was a full-time freelancer, but I also was keenly aware that, like, all of the responsibility of not getting sick and dying was sort of fell to me. And I think most people who sort of grew up in an older economy, even if, you know, they had a lean month, they still knew that they had insurance, or they still knew that they had, you know, a bonus or, like, something. And I wish people understood sort of how day-to-day it is when you exist in that economy. I really feel for kids who are just now graduating, because there are all these new and different ways to make money. You can make money by, you know, doing the old school, like, wage thing at night. You can drive for Uber. You can do TaskRabbit. You can do all kinds of side jobs that bring in, you know, enough money to stay afloat. But I also didn't have health insurance until I was, like, 26. and I didn't have any sort of, I didn't have anything to bounce off of. Like, if I'd ever had a really bad month, there was no buffer zone. It was like, you either pay your rent or you don't. Or, you know, if I got really sick, it was like, oh, I hope it isn't bacterial because I literally can't afford to go get it checked out. And I think that's the main thing, is even when there's all these different ways to make money or there's different ways to sort of be financially stable, sort of, you're never that stable if one bad thing is ruinous. When I had the most sort of quote-unquote real job that was the most within my degree, that was the most straightforward, most old economy, was when I was the brokest. It was a full-time job that paid me literally not enough to rent an apartment. And that was like market rate. And so the option was either leave, I guess, and do something else, or do something else in addition to that and bring in extra money and supplement it. And especially in a city like Seattle, you know, one thing my friends and I talk about all the time is our rents are going up 8% year over year. If your income is not going up 8%, after 2 years, you are out almost 20%. You are just making less money to get the same thing. And so I think that's one of the things that's good about it, is that you can find other ways to sort of top it off where you couldn't. But the problem is that you have to do that, because working 40 hours a week, even in a job that requires a degree, is not enough. And so it's not always about the finding the work. It's about finding the time in your day to do the amount of work it takes to pay for everything that I feel like 20 years ago you could have probably done in 40 hours a week. The story is, especially people of my generation, we did exactly as we were told. I did exactly what I was supposed to do. I did super well in high school. I took a bunch of AP classes that got me out of a lot of college credit. I got into college. I went to a university just like I was supposed to do. And then what it got me was a ton of debt, not very great job prospects, and a requirement to work 50 and 60 hours a week just to stay afloat. And I feel like that is true of a lot of people I know, that the prescription for what was supposed to be sort of a, like, progressive and effective life, and especially for me growing up, you know, like, in a single-income household where money was always a really hard issue, what I did was do the thing that's supposed to help you make a good living, and it has still only been hard. And so I don't know what it is that we're supposed to do to get it right. Like, I don't know what advice I would give to a high schooler right now, because the path that has been the righteous path for so long kind of doesn't exist anymore.
Hannah Brooks Olson is the newest member of our team at Civic Skunk Works.
And don't worry about her sob story. She's now working full-time for good pay and full benefits.
As usual, Americans just find it easier to adapt. And that's how we got what economists now call the sharing economy.
My name's David Rolfe, and I'm the president of SEIU 775.
So as we move towards this gig economy, in which increasingly not only do you not have an employer, you may have multiple employers, it's moving from jobs to work, what does the future hold, and what do we need to do to provide the basic protections and benefits that people need to actually have a decent middle class life?
Yeah. So futurists, I think, would all say we're moving from jobs to work. Economists are still fighting about this. And my view is that if you aggregate contracted, temp, seasonal, traditional freelance, new style, on-demand, technology-enabled freelance, I suspect you would find a number of Americans into the tens of millions, maybe as high as 50 million, who are doing something in addition to or instead of traditional work, traditional jobs. You know, to your first point, if 90% of firms in an industry or in a geography are playing by the old school rules with high wages and good benefits, they're likely to win. Because even the 10% that don't are going to find themselves without a lot of competition for open jobs and without the best employees. So when the economy was highly unionized, General Electric was a union company and IBM was a non-union company, IBM would just wait till General Electric settled their labor contract and then add 5 cents to the wages. And that was their new market rate, their non-union incentive. So the competition worked to produce upwards pressure. But then as increasing numbers of firms, often under pressure from their shareholders, started to take the spiral in the other direction, downward, we produced a separate set of problems, which included all kinds of creative ways to get out of being the real employer, only one of which is the on-demand economy. But now you look across the economy, and it's not unusual to see someone like a Lyft driver that I had recently. And, you know, I got into the back of his car, and he said, "You're my president." And I said, "No, I'm not your president." Here in Seattle, the Teamsters Union is organizing Lyft drivers. I thought maybe he was confusing me for someone from the Teamsters. And he said, "No, I'm a home care worker." And he went on to describe that he worked about 25 hours a week in his home care job, about 10 hours a week driving for Lyft, and then had some other sources of income he kind of pieced together doing things around his neighborhood or for family and friends. And that was his, that was the type of activity that he rolled up into something approximating a full-time job. Well, and he wasn't one, it was two or three or four. Or a hospital social worker who was an Uber driver for me recently, and she has a job in a hospital. But you know what? Social work jobs don't pay very well. She had student debt. She had a boyfriend long distance. And in order to make her household budget work, she had to have a couple housemates, and she had to have some extra sources of income. And so, you know, you're seeing these things where traditional jobs are merged with non-traditional jobs, or where people put together a whole bunch of non-traditional jobs all at once, or where the economic norm in a particular industry, say bicycle messengers or something, is just a freelance norm. And then you start to see some huge problems arise. What happens when these folks reach retirement age and don't have any money in their Social Security account? What happens when they try to access Medicare and very few payments have been made on their behalf over the course of a lifetime? What happens if they get injured on the job and aren't covered under their state's workers' compensation insurance program? What happens if the economy turns bad, they lose a job or an income source and don't have income replacement? And then the picture is not so rosy as just increased flexibility and choice in this rosy on-demand economy. What we did, what Nick Hanauer and I proposed in our article, and what others have proposed as well, is really borrowed on some very old ideas. Ideas like union Taft-Hartley funds or Social Security benefits, where regardless of your employer, a trusted third-party entity collects a small number of pennies or dollars per hour on top of wages and professionally manages benefits on your behalf.
My colleague David Rolf and I have proposed a new system based on the principles of universality, proration, and portability, something called the shared security system, which is two fundamental components. A new set of shared security standards, which are new labor standards, and a shared security account, which is essentially this virtual account that you carry around with you as a worker that isn't at the employer, it actually is yours. So the shared security standards include, for instance, a much higher minimum wage, a much higher overtime threshold to make sure that workers working more than 40 hours get paid overtime, includes a universal earned sick leave, maternity leave, and a bunch of other things that are found throughout the economy and that most good employers offer their workers, but that low-wage employers are more exploitive employers don't currently offer, which, of course, gives the most exploitive industries and companies this unfair advantage over high road employers, which is ridiculous, right? We want a race to the top, not a race to the bottom. And so you want to make these standards universal. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is this shared security account where you know, vacation pay is accumulated, earned sick leave is accumulated, all these benefits are accumulated in this account, so that you can accumulate your full allotment of it, what you need from potentially five different employers that you have at the same time, rather than not getting any of it from any employers because you're not full-time at any of them. And that's, you know, that's the real trick. And so there's all sorts of ways to administer this. You could have it administered by the government, or you could stand up essentially nonprofit agencies that have fiduciary responsibility to workers to administer these and have them compete in the marketplace for workers. But, you know, as long as you base the system on the principles of universality, portability, and proration, you know, I think you end up in a really good spot.
Of course, the Olsons are really just a reflection of our post-greed is good world, where outrageous income inequality is simply accepted, even by most of the people getting f***ed by it, people who should be in the streets or in unions, or at least in the voting booth, but are not. As usual, Americans just find it easier to adapt. And that's how we got what economists now call the sharing economy. We used to have stores that provided jobs, then commerce went online. Now we just have apps. I know we're supposed to think that's cool to drive an Uber from your Airbnb to the assignment you found on Task Rabbit, selling your ovaries, but isn't the sharing economy really the desperate economy?
I'm Tina Knoll.
I'm Nick Casella.
And we are standing outside at 2nd and Union in downtown Seattle, awaiting an Uber driver.
We've often looked at Uber very systemically as a business, but we really want to take it from a personal standpoint and see what the actual workers for Uber feel about the company.
All right, he's here.
Hey, hi. How's it going?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks.
I'm Nick.
Jeremy. Nice
to meet
you. Nice. Hi, I'm
Tina. We work with Nick Hanauer in that building right over there. Okay. And we're really interested in political economy and specifically just how the economy is changing in general from these sort of rigid employer-employee interactions to a much more fluid sharing economy where individuals maybe have a lot of part-time gigs as opposed to the standard 9-to-5 job and how we as a society develop from there. I guess the first thing is, how long have you been working for Uber?
So I've been with them since the end of July.
Okay.
So what is that, 6-7 months now?
Yep.
And how come you decided to be an Uber driver?
Well, I was doing it part-time while I was in real estate. So when things started to get really expensive and competitive in the real estate market, there were a flood of agents, and Uber was something I was doing part-time that seemed like I could scale it up to full-time.
Is this turned into a full-time job for you?
Yes, this is full-time, so I work usually about 40 hours a week. If there's something, you know, a little extra to pay off, or if I want to put some more on my student loans, I work, you know, another 10, 12 hours just to make that extra cash. And then it cost me about $7.50 an hour to operate the car.
Does Uber offer any benefits, or do you have to, any security at all?
So what Uber does offer is what we call the combo package of discounts on fuel maintenance and repair and...
going over a cobblestone street there. It's a little loud.
One of the suspension maintenance.
Yeah.
Discounts at retailers like AutoZone, and we have the traditional cell phone discounts to handle the data we use. And then they've just recently started in offering health insurance. I've worked across many customer service industries, service jobs. That's been my background and experience. And the one thing I see lacking that is being highlighted by Uber is ability to communicate internally. It's been my experience that, you know, they're really great at getting you going. But from there, the ball kind of just falls to hopefully a really helpful and responsive person at the help desk, or I'll get back to you in 2 weeks. And then being that it's such a hot topic in just the Seattle culture, they're not really worried about losing drivers necessarily. So their focus tends to be on just ensuring our ability to drive, and then from there you're kind of on your own.
So what are your hopes? I mean, as you, is Uber a catalyst for you to create a new career for yourself?
I see Uber as a way to be involved with the development of the new business model. We've definitely shaken it up. There have been game-changing business models popping out of the app-based rideshare services.
So an idea that Nick Hanauer at his political shop Civic Ventures came up with was this idea of shared security. And by that, he meant an idea of disentangling benefits from the employer and making them portable, prorated, and universal. With something like that system, would you find it as an Uber driver an extremely helpful medium to allow you to have these benefits that are not completely controlled by the employer?
Absolutely. That's something that is one way or another going to be part of the new labor style. It's one of those things where I could not want it, or we could all want it one way or another. The mobility of things like a 401k and paid time off and paid sick leave in an economy where we're not going to spend more than 3 years, you know, doing the same thing, is going to become super important as soon as it becomes apparent. And to me, that would be something that would help me feel like it's okay to take that next step and really strive for something better if I know that what I've already earned comes with me.
So it would increase the mobility in the workplace, you're saying?
Absolutely. Yeah, that would, because it removes, not that we have paid days off now, but if I knew that going into an office job, I would have the same benefits that I'd worked for the last 9 years to earn, it would be something that would help me make that decision.
So here's something I don't quite get. Why is it that Uber has become the poster child for this, the whole gig economy? Why is it feels as though Uber is really taking the brunt of the heat from politicians and union activists and people. Why is it? Why Uber?
Yeah, well, part of it, of course, is because they are the most prominent and dominant player in this new industry. And part of it is because their founder is really kind of an asshole. Can I say that? Personally, I won't use Uber. I'll go out of my way not to use Uber. But then again, I'm a curmudgeonly scold.
Well, you're more of a scolding curmudgeon. But
Either way.
So what would you say to critics who say that they don't want the government to allocate how many vacation days a worker gets?
The fundamental question people face in society is, should we put our own fires out, or should we have a fire department? And there will always be people who are free riders and would prefer other people to pay for the fire department. But that doesn't mean that that's what we should do. And, you know, minimum labor standards are the secret to high-functioning economies, and there are no examples in human history or on planet Earth today of high-functioning economies that don't have high labor standards. Yeah, and if I could just riff on vacation, of course, if every working American got an extra week of vacation, you have to consider vacation industry impact that would have. I mean, obviously, that would be fantastic for business, for a giant, giant industry, and put a lot of people at work to work taking care of the leisure time that people had. But even more, you know, in study after study after study after study, it's been well documented that workers who take vacations actually are more productive than workers that don't take vacations. And, you know, so overall, an increase in vacation via a national standard would benefit the country in a myriad of ways.
So right now we sort of live in you could see it almost as a dystopian future version of the 1950s where, you know, I know people who work and they're only allowed to work 29 hours a week because if they worked one more hour, they would be eligible for health insurance. Their employers don't want to pay it. So I have no problem imagining what the dystopian side of the gig economy would look like. Can you offer an alternative view of the future under the sharing economy? Is there an aspirational goal that we could be heading toward?
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly one of the most pernicious constructs in our economy today is the lack of proration of benefits and this perverse incentive we've given employers to keep people part-time so they don't have to pay them benefits. And, you know, people, you know, employers do that. You know, some of them are assholes, but some of them simply are competing with the assholes next door, right? I mean, it's very, very difficult in a circumstance where your competitors do that to not do that. We could easily eliminate that entirely by simply enacting a new standard which required employers to pay people benefits on a purely prorated basis, and then all of those games would disappear and, you know, the world would be a much better place. People, particularly with specialized skills, will find it easier and easier to sell those skills to a variety of employers, even simultaneously. And, you know, use the example of a writer. In the day, the only way for a writer to get the word out about their writing was through a printing press, which gave publishers of newspapers an enormous amount of power. And, you know, basically, if you wanted to be a writer, you had to be affiliated with a newspaper publisher or some kind of publisher so people could see your words. But today, obviously, the internet has totally democratized that and made it possible for any writer to reach any reader on Earth. And this has brought some benefits and some challenges to writers. You know, the old way of doing business has been disrupted and has been replaced with a new way. And some people have done better and some people have done worse. But there can be no doubt that it's easier to be a writer than it once was. And it's easier as a reader to have access to more writers.
Okay, so I guess the question is, should we be concerned?
Well, I think if there's a theme to our podcast, it's that the economy is a-changin'. And while we can't turn back the clock, we can choose how we're going to adapt to these changes. Whether that's something like the shared security system or even something more radical like a guaranteed basic income, that's a choice we'll have to make. But I think the worst choice would be to do nothing at all and let the gig economy slowly undermine the security of the American middle class.
There's something you said there I think really sort of hits home is that the shared security system isn't the answer, but it's
right.
An answer. It's a possible answer. I think that now is the time that we need to be thinking about ways to solve this problem because it is only going to get bigger and more unavoidable as time goes on.
And if all we achieve with this podcast is getting you to think about this a little more, well then I think, Paul, you and I should pop a cork and have a drink.
Aw.
But you don't drink.
I don't drink.
Okay, so you can watch me drink some champagne as you drink your seltzer.
In other words, it's going to be Friday night.
The Other Washington is a production of Civic Skunk Works.
Thanks to our guests Hannah Brooks Olson, David Rolfe, Uber driver Jeremy, and our benevolent plutocratic overlord, Nick Hanauer.
This show is produced by Tina Knoll at Large Media. Thank you, Tina, with help from Nick Casella. Our assistant editor and make us sound good engineer is Shelley Goncharowski.
Find us on social media at Civic Skunk Works on Twitter and Facebook.
To learn more about the shared security system, go to democracyjournal.org and look for our essay, Shared Security, Shared Growth.
Or you can find a link on our blog at civicskunkworks.com. And please subscribe to our show and leave us a review at iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcast.
And thanks for listening.